Honestly, if you were to say, what are you? In a word, how would you describe yourself now in terms of your career? I would say I'm a firefighter. It's provided a fresh identity for me that I really enjoy, you know, and I'm proud of.
At nearly 70 years old, my guest Craig Miller is one of the oldest firefighters in the world. He doesn't get paid for it, and he wasn't even sure he wanted to do it. But the question that gnawed at him was, if not me, who? In 2023, he wrote that volunteers comprise some or all of the staffs of more than 85% of fire companies across the United States. I had no idea it was this high, and I'm guessing most people don't. The funny thing is that Craig could have easily been voted least likely to ever battle flames. He's a public radio guy, you know, the coffee-sipping, tote-bag-toting, academic type. Or at least he was, having spent more than 40 years as a broadcaster and a journalist. He launched and edited the award-winning Climate Watch multimedia initiative for KQED Radio in San Francisco. He's also an accomplished writer-producer of television documentaries and even co-created a show called House Detective for HGTV. But in 2019, he moved from California's Bay Area to the Catskill Mountains of New York. The local firefighters pursued his services, and eventually they succeeded in attaining them. But the pleasure has been all Craig's. Volunteering as a firefighter has become one of the most gratifying things in his entire life. He was very adamant about that. I actually spoke with him again after our interview, and he wanted to amend one of his answers. Rather than labeling himself principally as a firefighter, he wanted to go on record as an evangelist for volunteerism and community service. Now, it's not quite as catchy, but I do understand and appreciate the distinction. But when that 911 call rings out in the middle of the night, I'm not sure Craig the evangelist is getting out of bed. But Craig the firefighter sure is. One might even say Craig the firefighter is a damn hero. Do you ever wonder who you'll be and what you'll do after your career is over? Wouldn't it be nice to hear stories from people who figured it out, who are thriving in retirement? I'm Ryan Doolittle. After working with the Retire Sooner team for years and researching and writing about how they structure their lifestyles, I know there's more to be learned. So I'm going straight to the source and taking you with me. My mission with the Happiest Retirees podcast is to inspire 1 million families to find happiness in retirement. I want to learn how to live an exceptional life from people who do it every day. Let's get started. Craig Miller, thanks so much for coming on the Happiest Retirees podcast.
Ryan, you're welcome, except you may have me on the wrong podcast because I don't know how happy I am, and I definitely don't think of myself as retired.
Well, tell me a little bit about your story, because I thought you'd still be great on the show, even though you don't consider yourself retired, because you have had like a pretty big life shift. Tell me a little bit about your story, your origin story.
In terms of my career, really goes back to when I was in my early high school years. I'd already given up my dream of becoming a goalie in the NHL at that point. So, and I became absolutely smitten with the guys I heard on the radio. And I say guys only because it was mostly guys at that time. You know, we're talking, you know, late 60s, early 70s. And I just idolized the disc jockeys and the newscasters that I heard on my, and this was the era of, you know, AM top 40 radio, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
2020 news, you know, I have to do that. You know, it's something, just a switch went on in me and I said, this is what I have to do. So I started pursuing it. I started, you know, the scene in American Graffiti where Richard Dreyfuss goes to see Wolfman Jack and says,
yeah,
I did
yeah.
that. I was that guy, except
really?
not because I was looking for a lost girlfriend, but because I just wanted to like get to know these guys and how all of this worked. And the local guys were in Syracuse were like extremely gracious. I think partly because those air shifts can get a little lonely.
And, they were happy you were there, right?
Yeah. So they would let me hang out with them, you know, and I got more and more into it. And eventually by the time I was 17, I had my first job in commercial radio as a weekend disc jockey.
Really? At 17?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not long after that, graduated from high school, went into the service, did a stint in the Army with Armed Forces Radio, which is by that time was already called American Forces Radio. So instead of Good Morning Vietnam, I was Good Morning Frankfurt. You know, I was stationed in Germany.
Okay.
In the middle 70s. Did that for a few years. Got out. Went to college hadn't been to college yet. Had no plans at one, you know, originally to go to college. You know, who needs college to be a disc jockey, right? So, but I had this thing called the GI Bill, you know, which was a use it or lose it sort of proposition. You know, you had so many years to use the benefits or they were gone. So I decided, I'll get a college degree. So I threw darts at the course catalog, and it came up, you know, business and economics. I thought that was the most broadly applicable thing. So I did that, got a degree in business and economics at the same time, because I was working in broadcasting the whole time I was going to college.
Oh, really?
I made the transition. Yeah. I was going to college full time and working part time, first in radio, and then I also made the transition into television, got my first job as a local television news reporter. After I graduated, started working my way up through the markets, went to Pittsburgh from Rochester, where I was at the time. Went to Pittsburgh and then finally to San Francisco, and where I spent most of my career out there. Yeah.
One thing I've noticed about radio guys is they know exactly all the city. Like, I was here, I was at KW, da 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 da. You know, like, it's like a sacred journey.
Oh, yeah, I can do that. It would be boring, but I could go through the whole litany. The thing about middle market radio, which is where I was at the time, is it's a revolving door. There is no job security. And yeah. I thought, well, you know, I better have a fallback. And that's really why I went to college, is so I would be equipped to do something else if this radio thing didn't work out, you know.
Isn't there a saying, I'm probably going to get it wrong, but something like if you haven't been fired, you haven't worked in radio or something like that.
If you haven't been fired three times, you haven't really worked in radio, right?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, everyone's always getting fired. Like, even the top talent seemed, you know.
Yeah. When I was doing that weekend disc jockey, there were in Auburn, New York. There were times, you know, and you're the guy, you're the person sitting there running the station, you know, at that point. There's nobody else around. So when it comes to be news time, you know, a lot of times, you know, after the news guy did his shift and went home, I had to do the newscasts as well. So I was, you know, ripping and reading wire copy, you know, when it used to come off the, when they still had those. Yeah. And doing a little bit of writing around that. And I found that I really enjoyed that. And I probably was better at it than I was at being a disc jockey, which is a very, very specific kind of talent. And I was okay as a disc jockey, but not great. And I really, fortunately, I came to realize that early enough to save myself and moved over. My first exposure to journalism was really in radio news.
Okay. Which I find radio news, I always found it more informative than TV news in some ways. Because there were less bells and whistles. It was like the person had to really be good at the news. I don't know if that.
Well, at that time, it was extremely immediate. It was the only immediate source of news. There was no social media. There were no 24-hour news, you know, stations or channels. There was no cable. There was barely radio. You know, Marconi and I were best friends. You either waited for the 6 o'clock news or you turned on the radio when something happened, when something big was happening. Yeah.
Because the radio was always on. So that was faster than waiting for Walter Cronkite or something.
Exactly. It was faster. And something else about that I always retained, and that's why I eventually moved back into radio from TV, is I never got over my real love for the fact that there are no visuals. It's the theater of the mind. When you're on radio, you have to create, like if you're listening to NPR and you're having one of those driveway moments, they call them, you know, where you're already home, but you're sitting in the driveway, you want to hear the end of this story. You know, you're creating the pictures in your own mind. And I love that. I love that about radio. Whereas TV, you're spoon-fed all of the images, sometimes ad nauseum.
I think Ira Glass said, I might get the quote wrong, but something to the effect of, audio is the most visual medium, which I think
pretty much what I've been saying.
Yeah,
pretty
exactly.
much what I've been
yeah.
saying. Yeah,
he probably
yeah.
took it from you.
I'm sure he did. Yeah, because you know he's. I've been widely imitated by people like Ira Glass and.
And I did want to get into some of those climate documentaries that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I think you did one on the Sacramento River, which you called mm-hmm. the most important watershed for all of California. Why is it when sometimes when humans build dams, it's bad for the environment, but when a beaver builds a dam, it's good? Is that true?
Well, let's start with the fact that beaver dams are much smaller.
That's true.
They're pretty ambitious critters. But overall, beavers are actually great for the ecosystems. You know, where you build big dams and you put them on rivers in a place like California to, let's say, generate hydroelectricity and also store water for when there's a drought or for irrigation. Many, many of the dams in California were built specifically to hold water for irrigation because it only rains for half the year in most of California, right? So, but the one consequence of that, the only problem with that is that anadromous fish like salmon, they have to get up those rivers to breed.
Yeah.
And so when you start putting all of those dams in the way, you start endangering the salmon populations, and salmon is a key player in the web of life, you know, in the coastal, you know, river systems and out at sea as well.
Through a lot of this science reporting and these documentaries, you ended up winning the AAAS Kavli Science Journalism Award. Did I say that right?
Yeah, that's actually, one of the most gratifying things that's happened in my career. And that wasn't me. That was a team of people I was working with. You know, we won that as a team that produced a program on 4KQED on rising sea levels on the West Coast.
Okay.
So directly connected with climate change, and I was very pleased and honored that we actually did. It's a very coveted international science journalism award.
You've also, like you mentioned, you did a series on HDTV. I think it was called House Detective.
I had already been hosting a program called 20th Century Home. I met up with a guy named Todd Easton who came out of ABC News. That was his background, and he was now producing cable programs like, you know, the kind you see on HDTV, you know, and so we started, because I had a little bit of experience with it. He said, how do you scale this up, you know?
Yeah.
Because you can't really make any money doing one-off specials, you know. You know, how do we get something going, you know, that's going to generate some income and do some good? And I think I was the one who said, we have to come up with the cops of home and garden.
That's a great pitch.
You know, we have to so in other words, it's whatever it is. We don't have to make it happen. It's already happening. All we have to do is go follow them around with a camera and document it and make it interesting along the way using various techniques. You know, and then what we came up with was home inspectors. You know, we thought that would be kind of the ideal. Follow these guys around. You know, these are the guys who usually in the process of a sale. You know, or listing, a real estate listing, they go around and they find the dark underbelly, the lurking monsters, you know, in these houses, sometimes for the buyer, sometimes for the seller. Sometimes sellers want to have an inspection so they know what might come up, you know, when buyers come in, they start negotiating and finding things. And so they can maybe fix them preemptively. So we actually, you know, we sold the idea to Home and Garden Television, and we did 2-3 seasons of this show, House Detective.
Wait, so also you've been a narrator for what, Discovery Channel, Travel Channel?
Yes, I have done a range of voiceover work over the years, some program and documentary narration, a little bit of commercial, and a lot of industrial.
Okay.
You know, when corporations, you know, produce training videos or things like that.
Oh, the ones that we all have to go sit through, right?
Yes, right. Or a lot of times they're marketing videos. Yeah, I used to do a number of those. My proudest moment was probably being able to say, "Meow Mix, cats ask for it by name." So,
wow.
So,
I'm definitely going to use that clip.
I wasn't the voice on the national commercials, but I did a corporate for them, and I got to say that tag. One of my favorite taglines.
That's amazing.
So I'm still available for voiceover work. You know, please call this number.
a lot of our listeners are big travelers. When you did the Travel Channel stuff, like what kind of shows did you do?
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous?
Ridiculous, yeah.
What's that? What is that?
A lot of the shows were things like, oh, God. They had this top 10 series where they, you know, there's like the top 10 craziest roller coasters and the top 10 monster trucks and the top 10, you know. And so I did a bunch of those. Now, this is going back a ways, you know. And I remember doing one on that walked viewers through the process of going to Undertaker school.
Whoa.
In detail. Yes. Yeah.
And that's an actual Undertaker, not to be the Undertaker in the Wrestling Federation, right?
No, that's a, it's like how to embalm 101. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
They did a show on that. Undertaker school. I think it was called Mortician School or something like that. Yeah. Mortuary school. It was called Mortuary School. Yeah.
Oh, man. So, for the best embalming fluids, come to, as a, you know, lifelong award-winning journalist and documentary maker, how did you then pick up from San Francisco and move to the Catskill Mountains of New York and start your new, you know,
we're
path?
Partially, ironically, we're climate refugees. I have to say the biggest draw was family. And this is something you probably encounter a lot when you talk to people sort of in my demographic. I'd been in the Bay Area for 34 years. My partner had been with me for the last 15 of those. And we felt like life in the Bay Area was getting a little oppressive in a lot of ways. The traffic, the cost of living, yeah, the crime, the acres and acres of homeless encampments and things, you know, it was just hard in some ways to live there. And not as hard as it was for the people in the encampments. It's not their fault,
right,
you know, but
right,
but it was not the same place that I moved to, you know, in 1986 and thought, I'm never leaving here.
Yeah.
And the other thing was fire season had things like fire season had become extremely onerous and
wearing
N95 masks for a couple of weeks at a time in the summer and fall, you know, even if the fire's not right next to you, the smoke, you know, would be coming from, you know, the Sierra foothills when the Diablo winds, you know, when the winds turn around in the fall and the Diablos blow everything out to sea, the air quality got really bad. We were at one point, I remember one year we were worse than Beijing, you know, in terms of air quality.
That's not good.
And they had to invent a new color for the color-coded, you know, air quality maps because they didn't have one that was bad enough. the ever-present, I'm fascinated with seismology, and that was part of my beat too, but the earthquakes were an ever-present risk. And there was just a lot about it that, like when a holiday weekend came up, that was stay home for us. Because you couldn't go anywhere because of the traffic, you know.
Yeah.
So we started thinking about getting out of the Bay Area primarily and getting to a place that was a little, you know, with a little more relaxed, serene lifestyle. But honestly, you know, we sort of wanted to stay out west, but every place we looked was it was either fire country or there are going to be water issues. There either were water issues or there were going to be water issues or, you know, or there were areas where the real estate boat had sailed. You know, any place within a day's drive of the Bay Area, as you know, the real estate prices have gone off the rails, basically. So we looked in Southern Oregon, which was rapidly becoming unaffordable. A place like, if you can believe, a place called like Medford, Oregon. You know,
Wow, I thought you were going to say Bend or someplace like that.
No, it's. And, you know, we looked in northern New Mexico, even, you know, a lot of different places, you know. But finally, ultimately, family was back here for both of us. We both had aging parents. We didn't know how much – we didn't feel like we had enough time with them, and we didn't know how much more time we were going to have with them. So ultimately, we said, let's go home. So we found this place, this little mountain area, you know, in the Catskills, and we moved back here.
Are the Catskills about, what is that, about 3 hours north of New York City or?
Just right. That's about right. Yeah. If you're driving it, it's just about 3 hours. Yeah.
Okay. Stand-up comedy got its start in the Catskills. Yeah, right?
Well, kind of. I don't know if it got its start here, but for many decades, you know, it was the summer vacation destination for Jewish families in New York City and New Jersey and places like that. They'd go to the Catskills, you know, for a week or 2 weeks or whatever in the summer. That was their great escape. And so you had, you know, big resorts like Grossinger's and places that became famous like that and brought in the stand-up comics and which was part of the regular entertainment fair. You had people like Shecky Green and,
you know.
And it's just, you know, there is a legacy there, which has pretty much died out now. Most of those resorts are closed and people started doing different things with their time off. But the Catskills are coming back. We've noticed just since moving here that it seems to be like one of the new hot new refuges for disaffected Hollywood types, you know.
Really?
People are like well-known actors and directors and people like that are like buying up all these places in the Catskills. It's we've become trendy again.
Yes.
So for different
the reasons. Trends follow you. I think
that must
what,
be it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you're up in the Catskills now, and that was you moved there about 3 years ago, I think.
In 2019. Mm-hmm. So it's actually more like four now, yeah.
Okay. Do you mind saying your age when you moved?
I guess I would have been, let's quickly doing the math. I guess I would have been 65-ish. I'll be 69 in a couple of months.
You don't consider yourself retired, but you did kind of find yourself thinking, this is a little bit lonely because everything's changed and I don't have my normal routine. Is that true?
Well, it's definitely been an adjustment. There's no question about it. There are things, I mean, we have, you know, acreage and woods and a pond and waterfalls and a lake across the street. And we were never going to have that in California, you know.
Yeah.
And a few people who do have that in California, you know, have either had it for generations or they have a lot of money. And
right,
so part of it was a lifestyle, you know, it's like we knew, you know, we wanted to kind of get out of neither one of us are urban animals, really. You know, we like the country. We like the mountains. And so part of it was just that being the kind of surroundings we wanted to have for this next phase of our life. And we were fortunately in a position when we could do it. But I knew that I never wanted to retire in the traditional sense and go, you know, fishing. Play golf or whatever.
Yeah.
So in my case, let's say, you know, I don't want to go just kayaking for the rest of my life. I love writing. I mean, even through all of the years that I was in journalism, whatever the medium happened to be, radio, TV, internet, whatever, it's the writing really that I enjoyed, probably more than anything. So I still do that. People ask me when I plan to retire, and I say when I die. take my last breath, you know.
Right.
Up until then, I hope I still have an outlet for my writing because it really does feed me. It keeps me connected. It keeps me alive. It keeps me, you know, from atrophying both mentally and in some cases physically. It helps. It's one of the things that allows me to continue to feel like I'm making a contribution, having a positive effect on the world around me, that I'm not just breathing the air, you know?
Yeah. So at one point you realized, I'm going to get more involved, and that's when you decided to become a volunteer firefighter? Or tell me more about
writing,
that.
The writing, it's an interesting segue. Great segue, Ryan.
Thank you.
the writing led directly to the fire service.
Really?
We got here, we learned that we're in this tiny rural community. It's all volunteer firefighters. You know, most firefighters in the United States are volunteers. Most people don't realize that.
Yeah, I did not realize that.
A lot of people don't even realize there's such a thing as volunteer fire. They just assume that we're all paid professionals. Well, we're unpaid professionals for the most part. I think the latest number I saw was like 65% of firefighters across the country are volunteers. Highly trained volunteers, but for the most part, but volunteers. So,
yeah.
But I was driving around, you know, I would drive by our firehouse and through all the other little towns and counties around here, and every firehouse had a sign outside. Desperately seeking new, you know, fresh blood, basically, you know, new members, new volunteers. And I'm like, this is interesting. I should write about this, you know. So I wrote a piece for this PBS website that I write for regularly now called nextavenue.org.
Yeah, we're very aware of that one, yeah.
I imagine so, which is aimed at 50 plus demographic. And the reason it was such a good fit is because guess who's manning all of these volunteer fire departments? They're all 50s, 60s, not all of them. But and the reason for that is because we're just not getting the influx of young 20-something and 30-something volunteers for whatever reason. I think the reasons are complicated. We can go through some of them. But so it's the gray beards, you know, and with apologies to the women because we have great women firefighters, the gray heads, you know, who are carrying the whole first responder, fire, emergency medical structure in this country is basically right now is continuing to work on the backs of people who are in my demographic or maybe the next one generation younger. This is a problem. It's a national crisis. People assume when there's, and because, you know, we live in an age, going back to climate change again, you know, where there's more and more extreme, you know, weather incidents, events, more extreme precipitation, more flooding, more wildfires. And people, we live in a society where people assume that if, when they call 911, that help is on the way. But I think there's a very real danger that we're going to reach a point where we're not going to be able to necessarily assume that. The volunteer, fire, and EMS force in this country is aging out. But I wrote about it. I started by writing about it. And then, you know, within a year, I was like in it.
You were doing, within a year, you had the big suspenders on and you're on a truck.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, did I hear that if you call 911, it forwards to your home phone number? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, better not. Because people are in real trouble when that starts happening. Yeah.
So you wrote about it, and then the next thing you knew, you were like training for it? Or what's the next step? What do you...
Yeah, well, you know, from the moment I got here, members of the local fire company were like actively recruiting me, and I was already at that point saying, you know, I don't know, I'm in mid-60s, you know, it's like, and they're like, don't worry about it, you know, we have a job for everybody, you don't have to become, which is true, you don't have to become an interior firefighter, you know, and strap on an air pack and run into burning buildings. Not everybody has to do that, although there is a bit of a shortage of people who can do that and want to do that right now. But there's so many other paths you can take. There's so many other jobs to be done within the context of a firehouse, you know, or a fire company of any kind. In my case, partly because my partner Heidi was kind of adamant about me not becoming an interior firefighter in my late 60s. So, you know, an interesting point about that is, take a guess at what the number one cause of line of duty deaths is among firefighters. Heart attack.
Heart attack?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It has nothing to do, you know, with getting smoke or burned, you know, smoked out or burned out or any of the other myriad of things that can happen to you when you're on a fire incident. Although the heart attacks are often related to the stress and the exertion of the work that needs to be done on the fire ground. But yeah, it's the number one, you know. So it's not necessarily recommended for somebody in my situation who's in my late 60s and on the first name basis with my cardiologist. But it was a matter of, you know, if not me, who, you know, somebody's got to be doing this. And there are, as I was saying, there are other paths you can take, which in my case ended up being driver engineer. So I drive the engines and I operate the pumps. And if I'm in a situation where if I need to pull out a hose, you know, get on an attack line, as they say, I'm happy to do it. But it's not, you know, or throw a ladder up against a building, you know, or whatever it may be. You know, I'm able to do that and happy to do it. But I think there's a misconception, you know, that everybody who's a firefighter has to like strap on a mask and you know, run into burning buildings. It's not really the case.
Yeah, you don't have to base jump with an axe into a forest or something. You.
Well, yeah, you have to do that.
Oh, that's the initiation. Okay. Well, wait. Tell me a little bit more though about the heart attacks, because I was hoping part of this could be a clarion call, if I'm using that right, for other people who might be interested in becoming volunteer firefighters. But I want to make sure they don't all have heart attacks. Yeah, me too.
No, well, I hope it is. I hope I didn't scare anybody off with that. by saying there were so many other things you can do, so many other ways to contribute, you know, that was an effort to like not scare people off with.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a limitless number of range of tasks. It's a lot, you know, and we need all the help we can get. Yeah.
And there's, like you said, there's a role for everyone. So if you don't want to do one thing, they need this other thing done. So
that's right. I mean, and there's even a whole if you don't want to do any of that, you know, that's okay too, because there's a whole administrative side, you know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we need a president and a secretary and board members, and there's a whole auxiliary side, you know, which is a division of the fire company that doesn't fight fires, but they're primarily engaged in fundraising. For the fire company. And then there's another division called fire police, at least in New York State. They have these people called fire police who are essentially in charge of traffic control at incidents, right? So there's just a whole range of things that you can do. I mean, if all you want to do is go down on Saturday mornings and wash the engines, we would love you for that, you know?
Oh, okay. Well, what about as far as, is there like a 60-plus sexy firefighter calendar? And if so, how do people get involved?
I hope not.
Sounds like it could be a fundraising tool.
It's been considered and quickly rejected as a potential fundraiser. Yes.
Okay, well, we'll put it on the back burner for now.
I look bad enough in my turnout, you know, which is the term they use for the firefighting apparel, in structural firefighting apparel. You know, if it's not too bad when I have my jacket on, but when I take my jacket off and I'm just standing there in the big trousers with the suspenders, I look like a rodeo clown. So, you know, I don't think there'll be any calendars.
Well, tell me, without the suspenders, you might end up accidentally on the sexy calendar. Tell me about how those work, because I think most of us think they're just like a funny part of the costume or something, but they're very useful, right? You have multiple suspenders in your...
Well, I do. I mean, I'm at that age now where actually I'm double suspended, because I quickly found out in the course of my training that if I didn't wear suspenders on my regular trousers underneath my turnout, that they would quickly end up down around my knees, which makes it very difficult to climb in and out of engines and climb ladders and, you know, all of the things that are necessary to fight fires.
Yes.
So now I'm actually double suspended. Yeah, right.
Okay. And you don't actually have to slide down a pole or anything like that, do you?
No, we have no pole, sadly. We don't even have a second floor.
Oh, pole would be kind of useless on a
pole would be
kind of
useless, yeah.
Building.
But it is interesting. I mean, it is interesting. I have to say I'm amazed. I live right above the firehouse, you know, when the siren goes off. Well, yeah, not above it, like on the, you know, on the same building, but up the hill from it. And so when the siren goes off, you know, I usually come like this, like 2 feet off of my chair or my sofa or wherever I happen to be. Well, the first thing that happens is this goes off, you know, the pagers go off.
Your pager.
I'll reset it here so you can. Okay. And then you hear that. And then you hear the series of tones, you know, like you've seen in the movies, you know, beep, 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 you know. And then you hear the dispatcher come on who says, you know, Rensselaerville Fire, respond to whatever. And by the time they're saying that, I'm usually halfway out the door.
Okay.
So I think I respond pretty quickly, and I'm never the first guy there. You know, I get down to the firehouse. There's already a couple who always manage to beat me there. And they're both my age. So, you know, it's like, yeah. So, I mean, I'd say I've been pretty impressed with the response of these people, these really dedicated people that I work with down there. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say,
we don't slide down a pole.
Well, how does it work? Are you on call at all times, or you have designated days?
You're on call, and in a company my size, we can't afford to have shifts. You know, we need it's all hands on deck every time. Right. We're always on call, quote unquote, but there's no ironclad expectation. No one will ever ask you, at least in my company, no one will ever say, where were you? You know,
we had
a call the other day. You didn't show up. What's the deal? You know, that you'll never hear that in my company.
Yeah.
And especially when you enter the fire service at my age, I learned very quickly that I had to set limitations. You know, I had to create some boundaries for myself. And I knew that I know there's things that I can do. There's things that I can't do. There's times when I can go and times when I really shouldn't go. And I had to learn that. And it's taken a long time. I still struggle with it when the pager goes off and I, for some legitimate reason, don't go. Maybe having to do with my own limitations at the moment. You know, it's hard to deal with that, but you have to. You have to set those boundaries and not feel guilty about it. Yeah.
I mean, so let's say you wanted to take a week off. It sounds like you don't have to like put in for vacation. You just don't show up. Is that how it works? Or
Okay. Well, I might want to tell, you know, we train every Monday night. You know, I might want to mention to my colleagues down there, hey, you know, we're gonna go to the Gulf Coast for the month of February. You know, so don't look for me. But there's no formal, you know, it's being a volunteer firefighter is like being retired all the time. You know, you go when you go, when you want, you go when you want. And when you don't, you can go on vacation whenever you want.
I think that might also be appealing to someone that might think about doing it. They don't have to feel pressured that it's like, you can't also live
the only life. Pressure. I think I can probably speak for most houses. The only pressure you're going to feel is because it's self-imposed, you know, guilt or whatever, you know, for not going when you think you should be down there supporting your crew. But you do have to set those boundaries and stick to them.
Yeah. Would you say overall it's been very rewarding?
One of the most gratifying things I've in my life. And I've done a lot. As a journalist, I've been able to get, you know, I've been on TV, I've been nationally, you know, I've been on the deck of an aircraft carrier during flight operations. Because I'm a journalist, I've had access to a lot of things that people, you know, don't normally get access to. I've seen things and done things that most people never get to do. But this, and I also did a 6-year stint in California's on a sheriff's search and rescue team.
Oh.
And that and this, I think, are two of the most gratifying things I've ever done.
Wow. If you had to say why, it's because of giving back or?
Yeah. It's because I'm really proud of the contribution that I'm making to the community and that I'm here to protect the community. On their worst, on your worst day, I'm going to be there for you.
Yeah.
For me, that may not float everybody's boat, but for me, it does. You know, for me, it's one of the things that feeds me.
Would you say if for someone who feels lonely in that stage of their life, becoming a volunteer firefighter is almost like the jaws of life to get you into happiness?
It's actually a great point because as you and I both know, one of the biggest issues with elder Americans is isolation, is social isolation. Yeah. Especially when you move to a small town like this in the middle of nowhere, don't know anybody. It's a tremendous way to engage with the community and to get almost immediate respect from people. You know, if you just come here and retire, it may take you a while to sort of win the trust and the respect of your neighbors. But if you come here and join the fire company, they know you're for real.
Yeah.
You know?
We talk to a lot of retirees, and I know you're not a retiree, but they I think a big problem is when you sometimes don't go to the office every day, you kind of lose an identity you had, even if you didn't realize that was a big part of it. But you've changed a lot. Your life has changed a lot since you moved to the Catskill area. How have you either recreated your identity or maybe you didn't? How would you describe that process?
Well, I was able to sort of cheat that a little bit by the fact that I'm still engaged in journalism. You know, I haven't really forfeited that part of my identity. But honestly, if you were to say, what are you? You know, what do you, if in a word, how would you describe yourself now in terms of your career? I would say I'm a firefighter.
Really?
Yeah.
I love it.
It's become more important to me than all the other things that I do. As much as I love writing, and I'll write until, like I said, until my dying day, I hope. But I really have sort of, I feel like it has given me a fresh identity, not a substitute identity, but it's provided a fresh identity for me that I really enjoy, you know, and I'm proud of.
also there's something to be said about how you had an open mind to try it. An opportunity came along and you tried it. And if you hadn't.
Yeah. Well, that's right. This is something that they teach you during when you're training you for search and rescue too, is to get out of your comfort zone. I think, how they say sitting is the new smoking. It's kind of like that. I think the more you stay embedded in your comfort zone, I think you stop growing in a lot of ways. And you stop, and maybe growing is even not that, you stop thriving. You're existing, but you're not thriving necessarily. So, when the pager goes off at 2:30 in the morning and it's 7 degrees outside, it's like, I'm in my comfort zone. I'm in bed, I don't want to, but I'll tell you, there are unforeseen rewards, to forcing yourself out of that. It's another nice thing about, volunteering is that you can sort of choose your level of involvement. You can reserve bandwidth for yourself as needed or as desired.
Well, it almost sounds like your volunteer firefighting is like 3 or 4 core pursuits all in one. And then you love the writing, so
it often feels that way, Ryan. Often feels that way.
Yeah. well, Craig, if people want to find out more about you or read more about you or about how to become a volunteer firefighter, do you know where they should go to look?
There's an organization called the National Volunteer Fire Council, which a great start would be to go to their website, nvfc.org. And there's all sorts of information there. But honestly, the best way is to go down to your local firehouse. Find out when they have their monthly meetings, when they have their trainings, and just show up just to observe, to ask some questions. It's like the old commercials, no obligation and no salesman will call. You're not – that's the best way to gather. It also gives you a sense of the other people who are already there doing this work. And you can see, what terrific people they are, which is an attraction too.
Yeah. And it doesn't come with a mandatory timeshare that you have to pay for the rest of your life.
No.
There's no commitments.
the timeshare you pay, the freight you pay is in time.
Yes. Oh.
And
well, you are a writer.
Occasional sleep deprivation.
Okay. Okay. Well, speaking of that, I will let you go. And I really appreciate you coming on the Happiest Retirees podcast, even though you're not a retiree. And
the
I think you're happy.
I'm still working on that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Aren't we all? All right. Well, you have a great day.
Okay. You too, Ryan.